You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Republicans are advising President Trump to think twice about his recent picks to the Federal Reserve Board. We'll look at how Herman Cain and Stephen Moore could affect monetary policy, and we'll learn what the Fed does. Now, the commonly cited statistics about autism are that it affects 4 to 5 males compared to every 1 female. And many research studies have used ratios even higher to study autism, leaving women living on the spectrum significantly underrepresented. But some researchers have questioned whether it's really a predominantly male condition and are trying to better understand how many women and their experiences are being overlooked. Dr. Meng-Chu Wan Li is a psychiatrist and clinical scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto and an assistant professor of psychiatry in the University of Toronto. He's a specialist in the gender effects in autism. Dr. Li, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First, can you give us a brief definition of what autism is?
So autism was initially defined as a medical condition that's characterized by 2 major domains. They're both early onset. One is having social communication challenges from early in life, and secondly is having what we call restricted and repetitive and stereotyped behaviors and idiosyncratic sensory responses.
And we hear people talk about the autism spectrum. What does that mean exactly?
So autism is a quite a heterogeneous condition, and the term spectrum actually means people may fall onto the autism spectrum across different dimensions, from what we call more mild characteristics to more intensified characteristics. Some people may have profound difficulties with communication or intellectual functioning. Some people may be really verbal, but also having lots of challenges in other domains of life. So there's high heterogeneity within the spectrum.
And what are some of those other areas of life that people who are not profoundly affected but are on the autism spectrum might have difficulties with?
It ranges from daily social communication issues, the load of social communication, sensory environment, which could be pretty overly stimulating for many people, areas what we call adaptive functioning, including organizational skills, and for some people also that include emotion regulation aspects as well.
So where did the idea come from that men and boys are 4 or more times more likely to be on the autism spectrum than girls or women?
So this is really a historical thing. So the first case report written in North America is from Dr. Leo Connor, and his report had 11 children, and 8 of them are boys and 3 are girls. And then there are some other reports, for example, from Hans Asperger in Austria. They reported primarily 4 boys. So there's a focus on the idea autism spectrum, or in the past, Asperger syndrome, as well as high-functioning autism or autistic disorder, are more prevalently in boys and men, and that actually results in a understanding that's based primarily in boys and men instead of, in other sex and genders.
So what I find interesting is that because of this early research and its emphasis on boys and men, that was assumed to then translate to anyone who might have autism. And it turns out, from reading your article and others, that the way that men and boys who have autism might behave or might demonstrate that can be very different than how women and girls do.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the risk there is that if the research do not give enough attention or weight to the minority of people having the condition, it might be overstatement to say that what we know from one sex or gender actually applies to everyone who have the condition. And this is not only an autism issue. For example, in pain research, it was predominantly in males, and then people recognize okay, there are actually quite a bit of key aspects in the pain processing or perception is different in females, and even the pharmacological responses are different. So it's really important to, you know, pay attention to all sexes and genders.
Well, and what I thought of right away was that, you know, I can remember when it was kind of big news that a lot of women were having heart attacks that were not being diagnosed as heart attacks because their symptoms were presenting so differently than many male heart attacks do.
Exactly.
And we are talking about the differences in autism between men and women with Dr. Meng Chuan Li. I'm so sorry, doctor. He's a psychiatrist and clinical scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, also assistant professor in psychiatry at the University of Toronto. And so, as you said, men and boys were studied more, their symptoms and how they demonstrated living with autism became kind of the standard of how people with autism were expected to be behaving. What do we know about how girls and women tend to behave when they are on the autism spectrum?
Yeah, this is a great question, and this is an area that we're actively researching and learning. By definition, the definition of autism doesn't really change by your sex or gender, but the question would be the behavior manifestation of that might actually be affected by one's sex or the gender environment. So, but also by other stereotypes. So maybe I can give one example.
Sure.
Here is that there is a stereotypical view that people on the spectrum actually do not have friends, which we know nowadays is actually a wrong one. Lots of people who do have friends and who have motivations to have friends. But interestingly, some research showed that in teenage girls who are on the spectrum, they actually showed a similar level of social motivation and motivation for friendships, same as teenage girls who are not on the spectrum, whereas boys on the spectrum do show slightly decreased motivation compared to boys who are not on the spectrum. So in this case, the social motivation seems to be more affected by the gender of the person instead of whether you have an autism diagnosis. A second example would be one characteristic of autism spectrum is what we call narrow interests or fixations. So, the stereotypical view of people's autistic narrow interest could be mathematics, could be patterns, numbers, could be train systems, could be space and physics. So if one only recognized these kinds of narrow interest without looking at the intensity of that or the exclusivity of that, we may actually miss some of the interest in girls and women, and which nowadays we know they may actually involve animals, involve literature, involve social systems, involve history, involve many things that's related to the human social world. Or even a collection of fashion or other aspects. So there might be some gender components that's playing some role. So if we're over-relying on our stereotypes of autistic interest, we might actually miss some of them in women or girls.
One of the issues that I found really interesting to think about is that because neurotypical girls and women tend to have really intensely emotional friendships and spend a lot of time talking and sharing, that females on the spectrum have to be a lot better at I've seen a few phrases, masking or camouflaging. Can you explain that for us?
Yes, so this is something that we really learn from people who are on the spectrum themselves, and the term camouflaging or masking, as described by people on the spectrum, really represents an effort that they put on to appear neurotypical. So it could be related to suppressing their autistic characteristics, such as stimmings or repetitive behaviors, but it also involves some intention and effort to, for example, learn scripted conversations and telling oneself to look into others' eyes constantly, or even learning how facial expression should look like from practicing in front of the mirror or learning it from the TV series, for example. And this is kind of like trying to fit in, but it also comes with lots of mental health impact. It could be related to stress or to exhaustion or even anxiety and depression. So although they serve some bits of social coping roles, there are some expenses that come along with it, camouflaging.
I was going to say, it sounds incredibly exhausting to be doing that, even the part of the day that you are out in public, even if you can kind of, you know, relax at home, it still sounds just overwhelming.
Exactly. So that's why we learn lots of people who do camouflage and who are on the spectrum would often report that they appear okay at school or at work, but they do need a lot of time when they're back at home alone and trying to de-stress and really to, you know, recharge themselves.
We're talking with Dr. Meng Chuan Lai. He's a psychiatrist and clinician scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. He's also an assistant professor in psychiatry at the University of Toronto. He's a specialist in the gender differences in autism. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you been diagnosed with autism? Were you diagnosed at an early age, or did it take until you were an adult? Did the diagnosis help you? What do you find most challenging about living in a world that is built for neurotypical people? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Meng Chuan Lai about how autism can be experienced in different ways for men, women, and also for non-binary individuals. He's a psychiatrist and clinician scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, and he's also an assistant professor in psychiatry at the University of Toronto. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you or your child live with autism? What has the experience been like? Did a diagnosis explain some of the challenges you have faced? And what would you most like neurotypical people to know about people with autism? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And I actually wanted to go back to something that I just mentioned. Researchers are also finding that there is a higher percentage of people who are non-binary or transgender who also seem to have autism. And what kind of correlation or connection is there?
So this is a topic, again, that we are learning and learning, but we actually don't know, you know, the reasons explaining that. So what we know is that in people who are gender diverse, there seems to be a heightened possibility that one has increased autistic characteristics, what we call autistic traits, or even having higher rates of autism diagnosis, higher than the population average. And on the other hand, for people who are on the spectrum, there's also some observations and report suggesting that the variances, the variations of gender diversity as well as sexual orientations are like widened or increased compared to people who are not on the spectrum. And to be honest, we really don't know what explains this co-occurrence, but I think it signifies the importance that clinicians and people who are supporting people on the spectrum need to have this knowledge.
And so when we're looking at the fact that women have been overlooked, women and girls, and that people who are gender diverse are not being included in research, what does that mean for diagnosis, for research, for support?
Yeah, so this really comes to the topic that we talked about initially, Judith, is that if the research about support or intervention comes primarily or even only from part of the population, in this case, majority boys and men on the spectrum, then it's kind of like only an extrapolation to say that, okay, this should apply to girls and women, but it may not necessarily be so. So let me give an real-life example. Mm-hmm. So, for example, many teenagers on the spectrum, that they would participate in what we call social skills group or social supports groups. And those are, you know, really to foster a supportive environment and really also to increase the social skills. Now, we've got quite a bit of examples that we had a group of teenagers participating, and there are six of them, but five of them are boys and one's girl. And not always, but sometimes the girl would actually feel less motivated because of the imbalanced gender composition of the group, but also maybe some of the skills or just the real life scenarios that people talk about doesn't really apply well to her own life experiences. So there are lots of aspects that we need to work towards understanding better in terms of having a sex or gender informed lens.
Let's go to the phones, and Lisa in Janesville is up first. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I was calling in because both of my children are diagnosed with high-functioning autism. My son was diagnosed at age 9, and I had noticed things with my daughter, liking animals, preferring literature, not liking large groups of people, wanting to be alone, but, like the psych doctor is saying, she made friends. So I ignored all of it, and I thought, oh, it can't be autism. We moved abroad for a couple of years, and the stress of the move brought out other symptoms. And at that time, when she received her diagnosis at 15, actually almost 16, the psychiatrist there had said that often with girls, they find the diagnosis doesn't happen until puberty or until they leave home, and the stress of having that change in their life leads to the diagnosis.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. And Dr. Lai, does that resonate with things that you've heard?
Totally. Thank you, Lisa, for sharing the experiences. This is really what we learn from lots of parents and also from many of the girls and women who do not have profound early stage developmental delay, but who do experience challenges on the spectrum. So as you mentioned, lots of the issues may only emerge at a later stage because of the change of life or the more complicated social context, but also it might be related to people's lenses looking into or interpretation of the behaviors or challenges. So, for example, there might be a tendency of a girl being alone to be saying that, okay, she's just shy, she's just an introvert. But having that lens probably prevents her from looking into the real social difficulties that's there, and also maybe those challenges may be interpreted as anxiety, but without looking into what might be the root of anxiety, but interpreting the anxiety as the primary cause of the behavior challenges. So yes, absolutely.
Thanks again for that call, Lisa. And Dr. Lai, there seems to be some evidence also that autism could make some young women more prone to eating disorders. What might be the connection there?
Yes, this is also an emerging topic that people found young women perhaps related to some of the need of routines and some of the cognitive rigidity, and also maybe for other unknown reasons there's a higher tendency for people on the spectrum, especially women, to have eating issues. But on the other hand, the other way around, it's also a new finding that in the eating disorder population, there seems to be quite a bit of people whose autism spectrum characteristics or even diagnosis wasn't recognized at a later stage. So it's really important to keep in mind the possibility of a autism spectrum background that may actually explain some of the behavioral challenges or life challenges they have.
Let's go back to the phones, and Beth in Barneveld is up. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
I
just wanted to add that, well, I have a son who was diagnosed at the age of 9 with Asperger's, and the diagnosis helped him in school as far as getting the necessary therapies that he needed. But then we had a move from where we had been living for a long period of time to a completely different state. And at that point, we made the decision to kind of take the diagnosis and not use it in the schools and kind of see how my son was treated with some of his peers. At that point, he was in
I'm sorry, Beth, but your phone is cutting out, but we get the gist there. So it sounds like Beth was both thankful for the initial diagnosis, but then kind of, you know, when her son was doing better and moved to a new place where he didn't have that label on him, decided to see how it was going. Does that sound like something that you've heard from parents, for instance, Dr. Lai?
Yes. So to be honest, a medical diagnosis is a label that can be used for a variety of purposes. And for the conditions of autism, you know, a diagnosis or medical diagnosis is only needed really when there are some what we call functional impairments or suffering that's directly linked to the condition. So it is likely for some people that the diagnosis is useful for a long period of time. And for some people, it might be the case that it's part of the identity, but it doesn't necessarily need to be kept on record if the adaptations or accommodations are already made or in place. So there could be some flexibility in real life, like how people make the best use of the diagnosis and support.
It seems like there are quite a number of women, certainly some men as well, but women especially, where they get a diagnosis late in life or later in life, not in childhood. What's the response from them who might for the first time feel that they are understood, or maybe even that they are understanding themselves more?
That's really one of the most frequent responses that we learned from people who got their diagnosis later in life, but irrespective of the sex or genders. And primarily what we heard is that this explains my past life. So lots of stories were that lots of things do not make sense until that I have this lens of autism spectrum, now understand why this is happening in this particular way. And most importantly, this also brings people being connected with others having similar or shared life experiences on the spectrum or being neurodiverse. And that's actually a very important a channel to really, you know, move forward with the life challenges, but also the lessons learned being on the spectrum for a long period of time.
And very briefly, it sounds like from what I was reading that a group of women who are on the spectrum came together online and have really helped kind of push for these changes.
Totally, yeah, and we actually, the researchers are really learning a lot from people who have the real-life experiences, and I mean, research basically needs to follow really people's life experiences to improve the well-being of everyone.
Well, Dr. Lai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Meng Chuan Lai is a psychiatrist and clinician scientist at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto and an assistant professor in psychiatry at the University of Toronto. You can find a link to his article, Quashing Sex Bias in Autism Research, Calls for Participant Rainbow, at wpr.org/centraltime. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. The prospects of one of President Trump's picks to the Federal Reserve Board is running into more resistance. A fourth Republican U.S. senator is now saying he would vote against businessman and former presidential candidate Herman Cain should he be formally nominated. That now means Cain would need the support of at least one Democrat to be confirmed, which appears unlikely. Critics say Cain would be too political and are concerned about sexual misconduct allegations that came up during his 2012 presidential campaign. Still, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said this morning that the administration has Cain's back, at least, quote, at the moment.
As the president said yesterday, he continues to support him. And we will see how that turns out. I don't want to prejudge it one way or the other. We will be we have already, in fact, started consultations with the Senate Banking Committee. Senator Crapo, who's a good man, a friend of mine, they will go through their own process. I don't want to prejudge it.
Meanwhile, there are also concerns over Trump's other Fed pick, Stephen Moore. So what effect could Cain and Moore have on economic policy? And just what is the Fed and what does it do? Heather Long is the economics correspondent with The Washington Post. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good to be here.
Let's start with the most recent news. Why does President Trump want Herman Cain on the Fed board?
Well, he wants both of these picks because he's really unhappy with what the Federal Reserve is doing. Particularly last year, they raised interest rates four times. President Trump argues that those rate hikes hurt the economy and really killed the stock market at the end of last year. And he's trying to send a message. And that message is new direction. And so he's going to bring two people who are his allies, who think like him and want lower interest rates.
So many of those opposed to Herman Cain say he's too political. What are they getting at there with that critique?
Herman Cain has three strikes against him, and that's why you see this really almost unusual revolt by Senate Republicans to say, absolutely not, are we going to approve Herman Cain for the Fed board? You know, number one is what you mentioned, that he's too political. He's raised a ton of money for President Trump. Just last month, he raised money and put TV ads on in Ohio on behalf of the president. So he's come out and defended the president when at times the president has been in, people have said that the president's made too many racial comments. Herman Cain is an African-American businessman, has said, you know, no, the president isn't racist. So this notion that, like, secondly, this notion that he's not qualified to be on the Federal Reserve Board. Yes, he's a businessman, and there's been a lot of great business people who have served on the Fed board and served very well. But Herman Cain has said a number of things about the economy and about banking policy and what's called monetary policy that just are totally off the wall. Like, they're not correct at all. He was in an interview just a couple of days ago, and like, he didn't know the difference between various types of government job and unemployment data. He was like mixing things up. Mm-hmm. And like, if you don't even know the basics about economic data, then it's a little bit hard to think that this person should be one of seven key members of the Federal Reserve who are going to determine economic policy when he doesn't even know the basics. And then I think the third strike against him is something we had on the front page today. There are four women who have accused Herman Cain of sexually harassing them. Most of these occurrences were in the late 1990s when Herman Cain was head of the restaurant, the National Restaurant Association here in D.C., a lobbying group. And that's a real problem. Obviously, we just had that very contentious hearing last summer for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. I think both Republicans and Democrats, they really don't want to open that Pandora's box again, particularly in an instance where there's four people who are accusing Herman Cain.
I want to go back to the point of whether he is qualified or understands economic and monetary policy to be in this decision-making position, because he is a big proponent of the gold standard. It was part of his presidential campaign, and he still believes in that. Can you briefly explain to us what that means and why he's a proponent of it?
Sure. It literally means he thinks that every dollar that you have in your pocket should be transferred, or should you should be able to hand that in and get a small amount of gold back for it. So that used to be how the U.S. currency and all currencies around the world for much of the 1800s and early 1900s were done that way. And that was a way to standardize the value of every currency around the world. If I knew that the U.S. dollar was worth, you know, an ounce of gold, and I knew the Swiss franc was worth, you know, I don't know, 1.5 ounces of gold, you know, you could, that's how you could set an exchange rate. That's how you could sort of have this global, underlying basis of gold that would underlie every transaction we had around the world. Over time, that sounded like a really good idea. But we've had a number of big crises, big depressions in this country and other countries around the world. And so when we hit that early 1930s and the United States went into a massive, you know, the Great Depression, people were saying, gee, you know, things are really bad right now. And having our currency tied to gold means that basically that you can't print more money. You know, it makes it very difficult to go out and pump more money into the economy, either through the government spending more on building bridges or public works projects, because where's that gold going to come from? It's not like we're just going to go, you know, discover gold on Mars. And so, that's why over time the United States began to abandon the gold standard in the Great Depression, and we fully got off of it in 1971 under President Nixon. We fully abandoned it, and the rest of the world has too. Most people say, hey, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s were pretty prosperous times. People are very happy that we're not on the gold standard anymore.
We're talking with Heather Long. She's economics correspondent with The Washington Post. We're talking about two potential nominees to the Federal Reserve Board, that President Trump is floating as possibilities. We're also getting a little more of an understanding of what the Fed does and how it impacts us in our daily lives. Let's turn to the other possible nominee, Stephen Moore. What is his background?
Yeah, Stephen Moore is he's very much more of a live possibility to be on the Fed board. He's really well known in conservative circles. He has a master's in economics from George Mason University, which has put out a lot, produced a lot of libertarian economists over the years. But Steve has spent most of his career at conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation. He was their chief economic analyst there at the Heritage Foundation for many years. He was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal covering economic issues. He has basically been the mouthpiece for supply side economics for the past 30 years. He and Larry Kudlow, who's now the president's National Economic Council director, they believe strongly in tax cuts, that tax cuts stimulate the economy, that tax cuts are sort of the cure-all to most of the economic problems that we have in this country. And Steve Moore's been a very good defender of that. Where people have problems with him is they say, look, he's an expert on, or seen as an expert on taxes and debt and fiscal policy. He is not seen as an expert for the past 30 years on monetary policy. And in fact, he himself, when he's been asked about interest rates or bank policies over the years, has made comments like, well, I'm not an expert in monetary policy. So it's been a little bit of a head scratcher why he's suddenly being put forward for this role at the Federal Reserve.
And what is his relationship with President Trump or with businessman Donald Trump before he was president?
That's a great question. So Steve Moore and Larry Kudlow and Art Laffer. So these three, Art Laffer is another economist. They are this sort of triumvirate, this trio that champion supply side economics. And they wrote Donald Trump's tax plan on the campaign trail, which ultimately became the basis of the tax cuts that were enacted at the end of President Trump's first year in office. Steve Moore has remained in close contact with the president. The president calls him occasionally to get his sound off economic ideas. And it just so happened that Stephen Moore had, in March, when the president was really upset with the Fed, happened to have written an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said just what President Trump had been saying, that, be careful, don't let the Fed hurt growth. And President Trump saw that op-ed, and he called over Larry Kudlow, the economic advisor, and he said, hey, Larry, why isn't Steve the chair of the Federal Reserve? And Larry said, well, Steve, he can't be the chair. We already have a chairman. We have this Jerome Powell that you appointed, Mr. President, as the chair, but we could name Stephen Moore to be one of seven Fed governors. And that's exactly what happened about a day or two after that conversation.
So can you tell us in very basic layperson's terms, what is the Fed and what does it do?
Sure. In a basic level, the Federal Reserve is our central bank. And what that means is they have two primary responsibilities. Number one is they watch over the banks. So they make sure that the banks don't do anything truly, truly scandalous, horrible, wrong, that sort of thing. And the other thing that they do is they help steer the economy, if you will. They help have their hands on the steering wheel. And the main way they do that is by lowering or raising interest rates. So when they raise interest rates, they're basically tapping the brakes on the economy. They're saying, wait a minute, things are getting a little overheated here. We're a little bit worried that various problems will take off, like bubbles could form in the stock market, or prices could start spiking. Suddenly you go to the grocery store and your favorite cereal or whatever is double the price. We don't want runaway inflation and we don't want bubbles. So that's why they sometimes raise interest rates, to just tap the brakes. Then in times of duress, like what we saw, we all remember 2008, 2009, horrible financial crisis, the central bank does the opposite. They cut rates, and that's meant to try to spur people to invest more, to spend more, to go and borrow money, because it's really, really cheap to borrow money.
And there are also 12 regional Fed banks throughout the country. What role do they play?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, much like most of the U.S. government, when they designed the central bank, the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. So, you know, we're just over a century of the central bank that we have today. Much like the rest of the government, they didn't want all the power to be in Washington. And so they created this really interesting system where you have these seven governors, of which Stephen Moore and Herman Cain could potentially be one, who sit in Washington and they help craft policy and decide if interest rates should go up or down. But then you have 12 what are called regional Fed banks across the country. I'm from Pennsylvania. There's one in Philadelphia. There's one in New York City. And there's one in St. Louis. And Chicago, I believe, is probably the closest one to you all. There's one in Minneapolis, one in San Francisco, one in Dallas, one in Atlanta. You get the idea. And the point was, just like our Senate or our Congress, you have all of these people who are spanned out across the country, and that makes it easier to keep an eye on banks all across the country, and it makes it easier to take the pulse of the economy because, you know, things might look good in San Francisco where the tech boom is, but they might not look so good in the industrial Midwest or in the farm belt. And so by having these 12 banks, it makes it easier for the Federal Reserve to really understand the economy and to make decisions that benefit the entire country and not just, you know, D.C. and Wall Street types.
We're talking with Heather Long about the Fed, who runs it, what it does, and how it affects us. She's the economics correspondent with The Washington Post. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's picks to the Fed, Stephen Moore and Herman Cain? What questions do you have about the Federal Reserve and what it does? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with Heather Long. She's the economics correspondent for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the controversy surrounding President Trump's picks to the Fed, as well as getting an understanding of what the Fed is, how it works, who runs it, and how its policies affect us. And I wanted to talk about that interest rate that you mentioned earlier, Heather. Interest rates are at 2.5%. Federal Reserve officials met yesterday and left open the possibility of raising rates before year's end if the economy improves. That's not what President Trump wants them to do. In fact, he wants the interest rates lowered. How exactly do interest rates affect us?
That's a great question. So the interest rates that the Federal Reserve sets essentially translate out to you and me and all your listeners. It impacts what rates are charged for credit cards, what rates are charged for mortgages, and what rates you might get, like if you want to go to the bank and borrow money to start a business or to plant crops this year, you have to go and talk to the bank to borrow money. Those interest rates that you're going to get, or loan rates, are directly related to what the Federal Reserve is doing when they meet 8 times a year and make a decision to raise, to lower, or to keep the same. So again, as the Fed raises those interest rates, you see it gets more expensive to borrow money. Those mortgage rates start going up, those credit card rates start going up, it's more expensive to borrow a loan. On the upside, if you save a lot of money, as the Fed raises rates, you get more interest on your savings account, and as they lower it, you get less interest.
Are there other direct effects that we, as just average citizens, feel that are the result of decisions by the Federal Reserve?
Well, generally speaking, it's also about confidence in the economy and what happens with the stock market. So, when the Fed, is cutting rates, that's usually a sign that the economy is not doing well, that it's on the rocks, that it needs some emergency stimulus. It's sort of like going to the triage department at the hospital. And, you know, you start to see a little bit of panic. You start to see maybe markets will start to fall in scenarios like that. Certainly we saw that in 2008, 2009. The same is true for a while when the Fed was raising rates in 2017 and in early 2018. Raising rates was actually applauded by the stock market. You know, you saw the stocks rise because people were saying, hey, the Fed must think that the economy is so strong that, you know, it's almost overheating, and that's why they're raising rates. This is like a vote of confidence in the economy. But we got to a point at the end of last year, you know, where the Fed raised rates for the fourth time last year to that 2.5 you mentioned, and that's when you started to see business leaders, Wall Street investors, you know, and even some folks on Main Street say, you know, This is a little bit too fast of rate hikes for us, and we actually saw the market fall, and we saw a big loss of confidence in a lot of parts of the economy at the end of last year, heading into this year. And I think the Fed looked around and said, you know, there's no exact playbook for what they should do. It's really a bit of a feel, how they feel the economy is doing, and they sort of corrected course and said, okay, we're going to pause. We're not going to raise or lower interest rates at all this year. We're just going to go on timeout.
Let's go to the phones, and Jonathan in Columbus is up. Hi, Jonathan. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question. Does the Federal Reserve actually have money, like a real bank?
That's a great question. Can you set us straight on that?
Yeah, that is a great question. Yes and no. So there's a misnomer that the Fed can just print its own money. The Treasury prints money, well, actually the Mint, but it's instructed by the U.S. Treasury. So the Fed isn't sitting around in the basement running the printer. That said, the Federal Reserve does have, like any bank does, they have assets. And in this case, at the moment, they have around $4 trillion worth of assets. They hold some of that in cash. They hold some of that in bonds, U.S. Treasury bonds. And the reason that they have that money is when we see something like 2008, 2009, that crunch, that financial crisis, you know, the Fed acts as the final backstop. Like if you and I ran to the bank and we said, we demand our money back right now. We're so scared. We want our cash right now today. The bank is, you know, they're not going to have enough money to pay everybody all at the same time. But the Fed can basically make loans to banks to help them pay when they're a little short in terms of paying, you know, the customers or whomever they need to pay. So that's a big part of the reason that they hold money at the Federal Reserve. It's not that they're, you know, hoarding cash, or they're doing it as like a final backstop, a final pocket, a final bowl of money, if you will, for that rainy day when some bank, you know, is about to go under or is in a very bad situation, and the Fed can step in and, you know, and prevent a bigger calamity.
We don't have a lot of time left, Heather, but I wanted to ask, it from what I've read, it seems that President Trump has been more willing to express publicly his thoughts and his wishes and his frustrations with the Fed than other presidents have of both parties. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate. We certainly haven't seen this level of hatred or directed at the Federal Reserve really since Richard Nixon. Some people would argue since Ronald Reagan, but President Reagan tended to do his complaints behind closed doors to the Fed as opposed to out in the open. So this is very unusual to see. Normally the Fed is supposed to be independent. It's supposed to be making long, much like the Supreme Court, it's supposed to be making long-term decisions in the best interest of the economy, not short-term decisions that could help somebody's 2020 reelection or not.
And a caller, actually, it seems it goes with this, a caller asked if having the Federal Reserve as a private entity and not actually part of the government would be an option.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. That's an interesting idea. It may be something to think about. I think the when it was initially conceived in 1913, it was partially helped crafted by several prominent Wall Street bankers of the day. I think the reason they wanted it to be a government entity is because they were hoping to have that check and balance of the president nominates people to be on the Fed board.
And we'll have to leave it there. I'm so sorry, Heather. Thank you for joining us. Heather Long is the economics correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about President Trump's picks for the Federal Reserve Board. And we also talked about what the Fed is, what it does, who runs it, and how its policies affect us. Thanks again to Heather Long for joining us.